Hi, this is Bennett Kelly. Thanks for listening to Cyber Law and Business Report. Before you take a recess to hear the latest internet law news and commentary, you are hereby ordered to download the WebmasterRadio.fm mobile app for iPhone and Android. Okay, maybe not ordered, but why not? You can listen live to my show and all our show hosts every day on our live stream or download past episodes with ease. So download the WebmasterRadio.fm mobile app in the iTunes Store or in the Google Play Store. It's an open and shut case.
All rise.
Welcome to the Cyber Law and Business Report. Get the top story on the hot-button internet legal topics of the day. This is your home for the latest on internet law and policy. Hear the latest net trends impacting business and have your questions answered right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report. Now, please welcome your host, the founder of the Internet Law Center, Bennett Kelly.
Good morning, and please be seated. This is Bennett Kelly, court is in session, and I'm speaking from the Internet Law Center in Santa Monica, California, the heart of Silicon Beach. Before we start, I want to extend our deepest and most sincere sympathies to Veronica Miller on the tragic death of her brother. And also with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announcement yesterday, we also want to do a little shout out for one of our past guests, which was notinthehall.com. And where you can go there and see who has been excluded and why. Would you actually believe that Pat Benatar, Chicago, The Cure, the Doobie Brothers, and even the B-52s have never even been nominated? So you want to learn more about that, go there. And as many of you may know, I'm fond of saying that any schmo can say he's an internet lawyer, but you have to see who's the real deal. And today we have the real deal. Our guests include Ian Ballin, the Dean of Internet Lawyers, who wrote the book on internet law, literally. And joining Ian is Evan Brown, the co-host of This Week in Law with Denise Howell on Twit TV and publisher of Internet Cases. Welcome both of you to Web Radio. Gentlemen, your mission, should you choose to accept it, is to explain the top stories of 2013 and why. And Ian, I will start with you. What will the 2014 update of e-commerce and internet law say about 2013?
Well, first of all, Bennett, let me say I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you for inviting me. There were really a lot of major issues in 2013. You know, one of the things that I've noticed in updating my treatise every year for more than 13 years is that the volume of law has increased dramatically. When I first started writing my treatise in 1995, the issue was there wasn't a lot of internet law, and the question was, how does the law of the physical world apply to the digital realm? Today, there is a tremendous amount of law. I mean, just as an example from my own experience, what I started writing with the intention of having it be a 200-page book was eventually published as a 3-volume set. It's now 4 volumes. And we're pushing to 5 just because of the volume of cases. The problem that we see now is so much law that there's a lack of consistency. And within the United States, consistency among the circuits and consistency among the states. One of the areas that this comes up in most frequently is online contracting. And what is required to make a terms of use agreement enforceable or other kind of online contract. And there are a couple of issues there. One of them is that that which law applies can make a difference in terms of whether an agreement is enforceable. California is probably the most difficult place to enforce an online contract because the laws governing what's called unconscionability, which is a doctrine that will invalidate an agreement if there is if it's too sharp or too one-sided. That the law on unconscionability is dramatically different in California than almost any other state. And so if you litigate the same issues around the country, there are some jurisdictions where the contract's more likely to be enforced and some where it's less likely. The other contracting issue that we've seen, particularly in the last year, is courts confusing the terms browser wrap and click wrap. And those are terms that were coined in a law review article in the 90s. A judge in Sacramento first used those terms in 1999. They're really not legal terms. The legal term, the legal concept is whether you have an express agreement, an offer and acceptance, or whether you have an implied contract where notice is provided and then people use a website or use a mobile app having gotten notice, even if they did not expressly assent or click a button saying that they agree. And in the past year, we've seen several courts around the country talk about click wrap licenses, which is a shorthand term for express assent, when someone gets a button and clicks their assent. Probably the gold standard for that is what Apple does, where you have to scroll down, check a box, and press a button saying you accept, making it very difficult for anyone to argue they didn't know there was a contract. And what's called browse wrap, which is a shorthand term for instances where implied assent is sought, or where there's just a notice, a posted notice giving you notice that if you use the app or use the website, certain things will happen. And I think that's problematic because if courts confuse one and the other, where the law is quite different, they're more likely to make a mistake. And that's unfortunately one of the problems. In the world of internet and digital technology, things are so interesting that judges come up with interesting terminology. And if they use that terminology in place of black-letter law, they're more likely to get confused.
And, you know, we've seen that to an extent, but the law on you know, the law on browse wraps is pretty much, you know, a lot of times you'll lose. And if you really have something important, you want to have it in a click wrap.
I think that's absolutely correct. I mean, again, as a matter of black-letter law, as long as adequate notice is provided, a contract should be formed. But as a practical matter, a lot of judges are very uncomfortable, particularly in consumer contracts, finding a contract unless a user expressly assented or unless the user acknowledges that they knew there was a posted terms of use. If a user says, you know, gosh, I had no idea there was anything posted there, judges are very reluctant, as you suggest, to enforce it. Even though as a matter of law, that shouldn't necessarily be the case. The issue is really whether the notice was adequate.
Now, there's an interplay with, we were talking offline about some of the other top issues. There's an interplay between the whole idea of whether you use click wrap or browse wrap and recent decisions affecting arbitration, because many of the web terms have an arbitration clause. And we've had some clarification on how enforceable they are. But if that's important to you, you definitely want to have a click wrap.
Right. The arbitration issue is a very important one. In the past, really starting probably in the late 90s, around 2000, a lot of internet companies started using arbitration provisions in their online contracts because if you forced an issue to arbitration, you could avoid class action litigation. And the standards for certifying a class are relatively low, and if a plaintiff can certify a class action, the cost of litigation is so high that even if the defendant did nothing wrong, it is often cheaper to settle the case than to fight on the merits. And so companies increasingly started using arbitration provisions. Because of that, courts in more liberal jurisdictions, starting first in California and then following in New Jersey and Washington State and actually even Florida, which is not one of the more liberal jurisdictions, but in a number of different states, started invalidating those provisions in consumer contracts. This goes back to what I was saying earlier about the doctrine of unconscionability. Courts would find that if there was an arbitration provision in a consumer contract, that was unconscionable. And the U.S. Supreme Court in 2011 in the Concepcion case said that those rules, those judge-made rules, are preempted by federal law. Congress enacted the Federal Arbitration Act many years ago to encourage the use of arbitration as a cheaper alternative to litigation. And so that really changed the dynamic. And in the last year, we've seen a lot of litigation, providing further clarification. There was another case that went to the U.S. Supreme Court in 2013 involving American Express and a group of merchants, not...
Looks like we lost Ian. Evan Brownie's, we mentioned before, he's the co-host of This Week in Law on TwitTV. He's the publisher of Internet Cases. And Evan, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, well, it's great to be here. And, you know, thank you very much for having me. And once we get Ian back, you know, I'd like to express to him how great it is to virtually meet him. You know, he said that he'd first published a book about internet law in 1995. So how humbling it is to be on a phone call with the guy who wrote the book long before many of us had even gotten on the internet in the first place. So
exactly. And yeah, I mean, yeah, they always talk about he wrote the book. I mean, this guy literally did. And in some ways he's also writing it different in a different way to the extent that, you know, he's defining law through his practice. But Evan, you've been very active here, and you've been following cases. What do you see as the top thing for 2013 on the internet?
Well, 2013, unlike several of the years past, I think has seen at least a couple of watershed issues. You know, it's easy for us at the end of every year to go and say, oh, you know, this was a there was so much that happened this year. But if you really look at it in terms of historical trends, most years are just kind of incremental changes when it comes to the way we look at the internet and the way it's regulated and all of that. And along those lines, I don't see that there has been any huge change or any huge transformation in the law. But what I see, what I'm characterizing as watershed or really kind of a transformational moment that 2013 has been, is in the way that a lot of these issues, which those of us who, you know, the more wonkish types of us who look at these things, have really become mainstream. And I think the real flagship issue has to be the NSA, Ed Snowden, and the greater public awareness of surveillance and the privacy issues that go with that. And it's been that cultural attention that's put on that that I think has been the single biggest thing of this year. But, you know, there's plenty of other things that have happened this year as well that are interesting. And I enjoy looking at the real human interest side of the internet and the way that it affects us culturally, socially, and then the law's role in coming to manage, you know, this great circus that we have as a society, you know, being online. So lots of different interesting things happened this past year. Yeah, I was characterized in those ways.
I was kind of hoping you would lead with a Dunkin' Donuts rant lady, but no, just kidding. I agree with you on the NSA, and I see you're right. I agree with you on how you characterize it, because I think one of the stories of 2014 will be what happens now that everyone is more aware about privacy. Everyone's more concerned about privacy. Does that translate into action on privacy? But I also see two other big trends that all flow from the NSA and that will be lasting in 2014 and beyond. And one of them is that you've created a danger for U.S. companies, because especially those that deal in the cloud. Because there's some evidence of, you know, job, you know, opportunities lost by U.S. companies, because people are now afraid to do business with the U.S. entity because they think that means doing business with the NSA. And then the other aspect is that this has created a shift in terms of how we talk about internet governance. And there's more, I think, of an emphasis or more of an acceptance of doing some other internet model that is less dependent on the U.S.
You're right. And I would add a third consequence of that. I mean, those are two big ones. And I think that another third thing that would stand on equal footing with those issues or those concerns or those calls to action, however you would want to characterize them, is a greater awareness of the individual and his or her role in protecting their own privacy. You know, the use of Tor, the use of encryption, those are conversations that just we didn't have nearly as often beforehand. And to a certain extent, I think that, you know, if the individual can become aware of those and take action, that will, for lack of a better way of characterizing it, mitigate the harm that is associated with communicating in a world where the NSA is watching us. You know, those, you know, it can do just that, sort of mitigate that harm. So I think we're seeing a reaction at the individual level being more more concerned about their privacy. But that first point you mentioned is a tough one, because it presents some questions that don't have really good answers. You were talking about the business fallout from this, and you know, I've had some conversations with some colleagues and other contacts in the field, and you know, we just kind of kick around this idea: what is a company's liability to its users if it makes certain representations to its users that it will protect privacy in a certain way? And clearly, when terms like that are written in a user agreement or a privacy policy or some other sort of communication, what have you, some kind of, you know, even in marketing assurances, the assumption is, or I think the general mindset is, the company's trying to protect against black hat hackers and carelessness, you know, not having the laptop, you know, unencrypted left in an employee's car and all that stuff. We don't ever think of it in terms of Big Brother watching. So I just really am kind of befuddled about how to even go about managing those questions of liability, because it's this monolithic force, namely the government, who's, you know, exerting these only questionably constitutional actions against us. And so the business risk is hard to pin down on that.
And then as a lawyer, does that mean in drafting privacy policies, you actually have to have a clause that says we cannot represent one way or the other the extent which information is safe from government encroachment?
I would like to think that if push came to shove, that a force majeure clause might be relevant to this. And I don't know if that's straining the concept of force majeure too much, but, you know, if we look at the general purpose of what that is, you know, the parties, if they can't perform because of some act of God, or, you know, maybe the NSA has powers these days on par with God, you know, and they can't perform, then they're excused. The problem with that is that a lot of these privacy assurances are by design, and I think it's a good design, outside of the scope of a terms of service. You know, for a lot of reasons, companies don't want to be bound contractually by what a privacy policy says. So that adds another kind of angle or layer of complexity to it as well. So I would hope that if an issue like this actually were litigated, where a company sought damages, or where a customer, an end user, sought damages against a company because of NSA access or government access to this, that a court, you know, looking at it from the company's, the provider's perspective here, that a court would read in some sort of doctrine of it having been impossible to perform or impracticable to perform, because we all know that without going to extraordinary efforts, it would be difficult to keep the NSA from doing the kind of spying that Ed Snowden and others have told us all about.
Well, Evan, you know, artfully, you know, kind of played the juxtaposition of God and the NSA, but there's actually a higher authority that I have to answer to, and that's my producer, and we have to take a short break. But we'll be back after these messages with Evan Brown and Ian Ballin talking about the year's top stories in cyber law. You're listening to Cyber Law and Business Report.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Guys, are you suffering from FD, fulfillment dysfunction? Let MoldingBox.com's online portal system for inventory, tracking, and returns perform for you. We have the enormous tools you need for complete warehousing, shipping, and handling of all your packages, no matter the size or shape, directly to your customers. MoldingBox.com can also fulfill all your nourishing, nutraceutical, and smooth skincare product desires, including green coffee and Garcinia, on demand. Plus, let our in-house printing and CD DVD manufacturing help you enlarge and maximize your coaching and business opportunity potential. We do everything: fulfillment, shipping, tracking, inside and out, and all in one place. Moldingbox.com. It's shipping made sexy.
Ever wondered how you could have access to your own SEO expert, paid search specialist, or social media wizard? Looking for help with your affiliate, display media, or email marketing? Look no further than the folks at Fang Digital Marketing. Fang Digital specializes in both paid and organic search, social media, display, and mobile advertising solutions, and is staffed by industry veterans from Google, Yahoo, and one of the industry's most influential PPC experts. Fang Digital's award-winning staff stays on top of the latest in digital trends and offer tailored solutions so they can audit your progress and build a roadmap to your success. Learn more about their expanding range of full-service strategic marketing solutions at fangdigital.com. That's FANGdigital.com.
Building better search engine rankings takes the right formula. Tracking those rankings is super simple. All you need is AuthorityLabs.com. Authority Labs uses automated daily rank tracking tools to monitor your site's performance or leverage their API to build your own tools. No matter what animal-labeled algorithms affect your ranking, you should be using Authority Labs. Unlimited users for no additional cost and white labeling can help keep your clients updated and save countless hours of creating reports. Whether you're running sites with just a few or millions of keywords, what you need is AuthorityLabs.com.
Welcome to Market Square, where you'll learn about fundamental human truths and up-to-the-minute trends that shape how and why marketers and people connect. Market Square, on demand anytime inside the Internet Marketing Channel, only on webmasterradio.fm.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on webmasterradio.fm.
And we're back with our all-star panel here to talk about the big developments of 2013 in cyber law. And we lost Ian Ballin. He fell into a black hole in cyberspace, but we've rescued him, and he's back. Ian.
Hi. Good to be back.
And we were talking offline, and there was one big development this year with the FTC on COPPA, the Children's Online Privacy Act, and so that would be a big area, wouldn't it?
Yeah, there are actually a number of interesting issues with children that I think companies and individuals need to watch for on the Internet. Probably the biggest development is that the Federal Trade Commission issued new regulations implementing the Child Online Privacy Protection Act, which is a 1998 statute. And the prior regulations had been in effect for about a decade. These are significantly more detailed regulations. They were released with 150 FAQs, and so it requires a lot of reading to wade through the material. There are a number of significant changes. Probably the biggest ones are that websites are now essentially going to be held strictly liable for the practices of plugins or other add-ons to their site. So if you run a company, you're doing things on the Internet, and you've got a third party that is doing something on your site, or with your data, you are actually going to be responsible for COPPA compliance. The big issue continues to be, as it was under the prior regulations, whether a website is directed to children, which under the statute is defined as those under age 13. And in that regard, the FTC looks not only at what you say, but what the website looks like. So if your terms of use say, this website is available only for people over the age of 13, and it's filled with cartoon characters and games that people under the age of 10 would enjoy, the FTC is not going to give you a free pass. So they look at what you do, not just what you say. But beyond that, for general purpose websites, which don't actually have to age verify or anything like that, if they become aware that they are collecting personal information from minors, they need to either delete that information right away or they need to follow specific procedures to get verifiable parental consent. The new regulations apply not only to websites but also to mobile applications. And quite significantly, the Federal Trade Commission signaled that they are going to start studying privacy issues involving teenagers. Congress, in the Child Online Privacy Protection Act, adopted this law to protect the information of children under age 13. And so there is a wide area where you have minors who are not, not adults under the state law, but are subject to COPPA. And the Federal Trade Commission has indicated they're going to start looking at those issues. And anytime the Federal Trade Commission signals they're going to start looking at something, what tends to follow are either guidelines, regulations, and here I don't think there are any regulations that could issue because there's no statute from Congress. So it would likely be guidelines or enforcement actions.
Right.
You couple that with the fact that the age of majority differs around the country. In most states, it's 18, but in Alabama, Mississippi, and Nebraska, it varies a little bit, and it can be as high as 19 or in some circumstances 21, or for married children, even younger in Nebraska, but it's not uniform. And under all state laws, contracts with minors are either void or avoidable, and there's at least one class action suit pending by children through their parents claiming that they should get credit card payments back for purchasing virtual products because under California law they're incompetent to enter contracts. So these issues, and particularly the FTC's focus, I think really suggest that the whole issue of commerce involving teenagers and children, which with mobile devices is quite significant, is something that's going to be getting more attention from regulators and class action lawyers.
And, if you look at what the FTC has done in the past, in areas where there hasn't been clarity, often they do through enforcement, not through providing guidance. And we saw that in the last decade with the enforcement actions over, some of the free promotions. Now, Evan, what do you think about that?
Well, in general, the changes with COPPA, the new guidance we have here is well overdue. As Ian pointed out, we were dealing with 10-year-old instructions from the FTC on this. So what's really precipitating the need for all this is, I think, really the expanded presence of social media plus the greater use of mobile apps. I have two kids, an 8-year-old and a 6-year-old, and the way that they use mobile apps is so different, and the means by which information could be transmitted is so so different in kind from sitting at the computer, playing a game, visiting a website, doing what have you there. So I think that of course, there's nothing that I could really add or detract to what Ian was saying, kind of laying the groundwork with all of this. But those, the ways in which the use of the technology has changed really underscores the importance for greater understanding of this, because without that, there was a real opportunity for some gaps to fall in, for gaps for things to fall through. Even looking at things like location information, things that just weren't nearly as relevant in 1998 and 2000, when we had the guidance from these things, so much of a transformation there.
I should add that Evan is from Chicago, and by saying nothing, I do shall add or detract. He evoked Illinois' most famous son of Abraham Lincoln from the Gettysburg Address. Nothing we say here can add or detract to, I forget the rest of it, but any event.
And also, the world will little note nor long remember, right?
I think that part applies to the show. But Ian, in terms of this area, the one thing we've seen is a great sensitivity of the regulators to mobile apps. And, for example, in California, the Attorney General Harris has a great sensitivity to it. The outgoing head of the National Association of Attorney Generals, Doug Gansler, he's expressed a great interest in addressing this issue. And so it seems like this is an area we're probably going to see something happen in 2014. We just don't know what.
I think there are going to be a lot of developments. Certainly, the Attorney General in California has been extremely active mobile apps. I mean, really, I think in California we've seen more activity involving the internet than we've seen at any time in almost 8 years. In the 2002 to 2004 area, California passed a number of first in the nation laws involving the first security breach notification statute, the first law requiring that companies post a privacy policy, and the first law requiring that companies maintain reasonable security procedures and require parties that collect information from them to do the same. And what we've seen, I would extend it a little bit more than a year, maybe the last 14 months. Attorney General Harris first started by sending out letters to several hundred app developers. Then she actually filed a suit against Delta Airlines. I think there's some significant issues of federal preemption in that lawsuit, but in any case, it reflected a fairly aggressive move. January 2013, we got the guidelines, Privacy on the Go, for mobile app
yes.
developers. I think that what we'll see in 2014 is more enforcement efforts. I think that, we also see in the antitrust area, the California Attorney General has been quite active. So I think it's fair to assume that Attorney General Harris in California is going to continue to push the boundaries and push for more enforcement and possibly more regulation. And I do think that that mobile app developers have to pay particularly close attention.
And just in, the White House is expected to release a review board's report on the NSA that is recommending that the NSA should not keep the phone database and also calling for reform of the NSA. So definitely something we'll be talking about next year. Evan, anything you want to add on Kamala Harris? In Illinois, are they as active in enforcement?
Well, certainly not as active. Attorney General Harris out there in California certainly gets the press for these things, releasing those different publications, those guidance on that, and what Ian was talking about, the January Privacy on the Go recommendation. So in Illinois, we don't see nearly as much of that. Certainly doesn't get the press, but kudos to Attorney General Harris, not only for what she's doing with privacy, but she's active in a lot of different areas with the internet that are relevant to the top stories of 2013. I know the charges were filed. I'm not sure what the exact status is against the purveyor of that revenge porn site. She's active in a lot of different ways. Pressing issues.
That touches on a big issue that I saw for 2013. And you had a bunch of attorney generals actually petition to Congress to amend the Communications Decency Act, Section 230 immunity, which provides immunity for websites that have forums for the comments of third parties. And so they wanted immunity from state criminal laws, which caused howls within the internet community. But it seems that as we have this whole debate about revenge porn sites and some of the reputation sites, that there's been this battle going back and forth. For example, the case with the Dirty, over the extent to which Section 230 covers immunity in these cases. Ian, what do you think of the Dirty decision?
That's a very interesting case, and unfortunately, the cases with the worst facts tend to make the worst law. Section 230 has been one of those laws that has really fostered the development of the commercial internet. If you look at 230, which preempts a lot of secondary liability claims under state law and even some under federal law, particularly defamation, which is has been just an area of tremendous litigation. And then in addition, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which creates harbor, the protective provisions for domain name registrars under the Anti-Cyber Squad and Consumer Protection Act. You know, these kind of laws that were enacted by Congress in the 1990s to create exemptions or safe harbor for Internet companies have been very important in fostering the development of these businesses. What has happened is you have a couple of companies that are really pushing the bounds. And so what's happened is we started to see a divergence in the way the law is construed. The Ninth Circuit, a couple of years ago in the Roommate.com case, the court construed the term development very broadly so that a website that otherwise would have CDA protection under Section 230 would lose it if the way they set up their website, the user content is essentially directed or a function of the way the company set up the website, and therefore they developed it and they don't have the immunity. The Roommates.com case is a really good example of that, where in that case the court held they had no immunity. They ended up having to litigate another 4 years before ultimately being not liable. And the difference, Fourth Circuit, which has the strongest and the broadest interpretation of the CDA, pointed out in a case that an immunity is not very useful if you have to go to trial to prove your entitlement to the exemption. And at least in the Fourth Circuit, it's an issue that could be resolved as early as possible in a case because of the importance of the overriding federal policy. So you have the Fourth Circuit, which is extremely protective of Internet and digital sites. You have the Ninth Circuit, which has a spongier test that allows more room for plaintiffs to argue around it. And then what we've got now, the Dirty case was brought in Kentucky before, in a very conservative jurisdiction, before an older judge who's not necessarily the most internet savvy, on very bad facts. You have a website that took a private individual and accused her of being unchaste. And made a lot of very nasty comments that indeed were actionable. Not just that they're nasty, but they would be actionable directly as defamation and under other state torts. And the line between what was user generated and what came from the site was really blurred. So now you've got another circuit, the Sixth Circuit, that's going to have to consider the case. And the problem is if on these bad facts, the court, agrees with the judge and the jury in that case that there's no CDA protection, they may end up rule that also fails to provide protection for mainstream internet sites. And this I think is the biggest problem. That sites, there are a couple of sites out there that are trying to push the envelope in terms of what they do and what they can get away with, and it may make things more difficult for the rest of the internet.
So in other words, what good is a bright line rule if it's a dotted line?
Exactly, and it's in some plays it's blurred, not even dotted.
But it is a great. I mean, they talk about difficult cases make difficult law a bad law. But I mean, you have a case involving a cheerleader for the Cincinnati Bengals, and who was a high school student. Who was teaching a high school, said it affected her reputation as a high school teacher. But then she was arrested for having sex with a minor, which turned out to be one of her students who she's now engaged to. So regardless of how the Sixth Circuit decides, I see a TV movie coming out of this one. Evan, what do you think about the whole CDA battle?
Well, I mean, we're definitely at a point where Section 230 is really being stretched. I don't know if it's being stretched to its breaking point. Probably not. But what we see is this real strain on it because of, I think we could characterize them as opportunistic websites like The Dirty, like isanyoneup.com, like is yougotposted.com, which is the subject of the charges that Attorney General Harris filed last week. These website operators recognize the immunity that Section 230 affords and do things that really are not good business practices. They're just not nice, polite things to do, you know, encourage, or even, we don't even have to characterize it that way, just by merely providing a platform for to post embarrassing photos, contact information on people. So from a real gut perspective, we recognize that those things just aren't right, and those aren't the types of things that we want to permit in a law-abiding society. And unfortunately, Section 230 steps in and at least makes it difficult for people to obtain a civil remedy against the website operator, and will likely present some real challenges to criminal enforcement of California law pertaining to identity theft and extortion. So, yes, I'll be the make it 3 out of 3 of us to observe that bad facts make bad law, difficult facts make difficult law. But at the same time, I'm not sure that Section 230 needs to be thrown out, that it needs to be rewritten. When we have decisions like the roommates.com decision that Ian was talking about that came out a number of years ago, where we can make a pretty factually specific inquiry as to what it is that the website operator is doing. And if we can look at those facts and evaluate whether what it is that they're doing is really enough to make them become a provider of the information itself that is allegedly tortious or allegedly criminal or what have you, if the courts allow a very factual specific inquiry to be made, then I think that there's room for these folks who start up these revenge porn websites or public sites like Dirty, which is a little bit different, but it still is scandalous, encouraging scandalous information to be published. I think there's room to see that they don't get too much of a hold.
Yes, I mean, there's a visceral reaction to it. And I'd like to quote one of our fellow guests in the past is Mark Randazza, who does some work in this area for victims. And he says, "I want to hurt isanyonedown.com. I want to hurt them bad. Who's with me?" And so that's the visceral reaction you have. But we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll take you to the final part of our year-end show with Ian Ballin and Evan Brown. You're listening to Cyber Law.
Stay tuned for more of the Cyber Law and Business Report after this brief recess for our sponsors.
Why do over 15,000 small businesses love working with Infusionsoft?
Because we believe in people and their dreams.
We empower entrepreneurs, and our groundbreaking tools help small businesses grow and thrive.
We listen. We care.
We serve our customers, and we do what we say we'll do. We're always trying to find new ways to innovate and to improve our all-in-one sales and marketing platform. Most of all, from email to e-commerce,
we help small businesses like yours succeed.
Go to infusionsoft.com/radio to watch a free product demo. That's infusionsoft.com/radio.
And a bit.
There are many things we would love to catch. Catching the final out of a baseball game.
And that's the ball game.
Reeling that big catch of the day. Or catching a ride home.
Taxi!
How about catching more attention, like the biggest retail brands on earth? Introducing Catchy.com, where they sell short branded attractive.com domain names. Use a short and catchy brand, just like Sony, Visa, and Nike, for your next business venture. You can even rent to own for as low as $100 a month. Catch a big break for your business with Catchy.com.
I'm John Ball, and I'm one of the founders of Page One Power. Page One Power is a custom link building firm based in Boise, Idaho. We increase search rankings and web traffic for world-class brands and mom-and-pop shops all around the globe. Our link building strategies work because we focus on relevancy and quality, and we don't outsource anything. Our in-house staff of professional writers and researchers is the best in the industry. We're the link builders you've been looking for. Visit us today at pageonepower.com.
Webmasterradio.fm is the destination for education, entertainment, and engagement.
Engage with our panel of on-air experts and peers by following us on Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and LinkedIn so you can reach us before and after every program. We also feature our exclusive real-time chat room where we welcome all listeners to engage with our show hosts during every live show. You can listen to WebmasterRadio.fm on air or on demand from our website or through iTunes, Stitcher, or however you get your podcasts. Interact and stay informed by following us on Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Just search for WebmasterRadio.fm.
The best gavel-to-gavel legal news and information on the net is right here. This is the Cyber Law and Business Report, only on WebmasterRadio.fm.
And we're back. This is Bennett Kelly taking you to the final part of our year-end edition. We've done 120 shows now at the, as we conclude our third year. And we want to thank all of you for listening these past 3 years, and I hope you've enjoyed it. So as we wrap up and look at what were the bigger stories, there are certainly some stories that kind of gave a little chuckle to us, or certain people we'd like to shout out as heroes or zeros. Evan, did any come to mind?
Well, I mean, we got to remember that 2013 was Anthony Weiner Redux. That we can't forget about that. That involved the internet and, you know, people making bad decisions on what to do online. At least those, you know, his shenanigans, the second round of that were exposed in 2013. So that always can elicit a chuckle, right?
Oh, certainly. And it definitely was definitely one to get a chuckle. But anything else come to mind that you like? For example, I really liked the Dunkin' Donuts lady story. It was something about it showed the viral nature of the internet in a way that was astounding. And that here was a person who assumed that this was a tool that she could use to extract retribution against this poor, helpless worker. And instead, it was quite the opposite. You know, she was out of work and more or less had to hide.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I think in general, the whole story of things going viral is something that will only increase as more people have cameras and the ability to publish, and we are tapped into this constant stream of content through social media, what have you. I mean, I think there are a number of interesting examples of things like that going viral from the past year. You know, there was the kid who was, for example, worked at Golden Corral and filmed how, the state inspectors or the city inspectors, I don't remember, were there to look at the kitchen, and somebody had rolled this whole big cart of meat out back by the trash can to avoid being inspected. So, you know, that's just a natural consequence of social media and the sharing that we have the ability to do in our culture today afforded by technology. You know, we'll only see more of that in the future.
Well, I think that's true. I think, you know, we're going to see just the way stories spread rapidly. I mean, it has changed. You know, we used to talk about a 24-hour news cycle. I mean, we're talking about an hour news cycle.
Well, sure.
Things get spread so rapidly.
And it's got an underbelly, a dark side, too. If you remember after the Boston bombings, the Reddit community to trying to identify the suspect. You remember a couple of days later, FBI released photos of the Sarnaev brothers, and we didn't know they were the Sarnaev brothers yet. We only knew them by the photos. And then, you know, thousands of people got on Reddit, and there was that poor student missing from Brown University who was, a lot of people were thinking that he had been involved with the Boston bombing. So there can be a real downside to it as well. And I think we see that almost in every story.
But it also, I don't know if that's unique to the internet, because if I mention the name Richard Jewell, and so remember him from the Atlanta bombings. I mean, granted, there was the internet in 96, but not really in a major way. That was network TV messing that one up.
Right. Now the mess up can be instant rather than taking a few days like the story of Richard Jewell to unfold.
That's the thing. I mean, the internet is a tool for spreading information, you know, disinformation or not. And so
now there are just so many interesting little aspects of human interest that have a law and technology angle on them. You know, I'm looking at my list here. You know, Bitcoin. I think we couldn't talk about the year in review when it comes to the internet without talking about Bitcoin and all the monetary and all the cultural and the legal issues that it presents. You know, we had Silk Road, the infamous online dark, you know, black market marketplace get raided by the FBI and shut down. But we're also seeing more mainstream use of Bitcoin. There was I forget the name of the company now. There's a company in Australia who's willing to accept Bitcoin payments for, they make these like off-road carts. You know, I think of them as kind of between a ATV and a golf cart. They'll accept Bitcoin payments to get around unfavorable international exchange rates with currency. So I think that Bitcoin will be a really interesting thing to watch in the next year. We've seen some interesting developments in 2013. It looks like it's experiencing a big bubble right now. So the whole notion of alternative forms of currency, whether it be Bitcoin or something else, other some form of cryptocurrency, could really be an interesting family of developments to watch in the future.
Yeah, I've seen that some one of the things driving Bitcoin is really more of an ideological thing. You know, kind of do the radar away from government regulation and. Although at the same time, Bitcoin has been sitting down with the Treasury people to try to make sure that they're complying with, you know, bank transfer laws and things of that nature. And we actually we're going to have a show on Bitcoin, but unfortunately the guy had to cancel the morning of the show. But we definitely will be covering that in the new year. And we're also seeing, you know, some problems with Bitcoin. You know, Silk Road, for example, is Bitcoin really a tool for money laundering and for, you know, illicit transactions? But at the same time, you know, Bitcoin is having some of the problems that any other financial institution is having, and that is hacking. And there were several million dollars worth of Bitcoins that were stolen through hackers.
Right, right. And then that was so interesting. You could kind of watch that happen in real time. And you know, what are the remedies to those people who have that currency taken from them if the means by which they got it were not lawful? That presents some real interesting contract questions that go back to first year of law school.
Now, we started the year with a show on the death of Aaron Swartz, and you know, I imagine in 2014, and, you know, his death and regarding, you know, from what appeared to be an overzealous prosecution under the Computer Fraud Abuse Act that led to him committing suicide rather than spending jail time, has led to a renewed focus over the copyright issue, and this may come up as the copyright comes up for renewal in legislation. And you know, he was busted for making available academic papers. And that was treated as a violation of the Computer Fraud Abuse Act, and the U.S. Attorney was pushing for jail time. And so I think that's going to be a big issue in 2014. What is the role of copyright? And you're going to have a battle between that tech community and the content community, which you may see also in Antigua, as we had discussed in the recent show, too, with the piracy issue there.
Sure. I mean, Aaron Swartz is such a crystallizing symbol for a number of important issues on that front. I mean, you know, first of all, what is the role of criminal enforcement against things like a violation of terms of service? And that we naturally can expand on to questions of what's the role of criminal enforcement of copyright law. I don't think there was a criminal copyright component to his case there, but, you know, it raises these natural questions. And when we think of Aaron Swartz, we think of the great efforts that he did to raise awareness about SOPA and PIPA. And, you know, he was one of the founders of Reddit, you know, after all. And, you know, this community that really allows for the communications about these important issues. And so, you know, there's no doubt that those things for which Aaron Swartz stood and for which his death really provides a catalyst for rallying, those issues are going to continue way into the future and force a real important discussion about the role of copyright, what it plays, what effect it has on innovation, and more importantly, what's the proper role of the government to come in and enforce certain interests at the risk of of violating important First Amendment and privacy interests. So very significant event in this space that, you know, that his death that happened in the first part of this year, but it, you know, naturally will extend for a long period of time into the kind of discussions and transformations that we're going to see in the law.
And well, we're running short on time, but I want to take this moment to thank all our guests today, Evan and Ian. You know, it's a privilege to have such, you know, talent as you guys on the show. And but I also want to thank our guests throughout the year, the, you know, the many great people who took the time to talk internet law with me and our listeners. Particularly shout out to EFF for their many contributions. Rebecca Madigan, who's been on here countless times, Dan Tynan, Brendan Christian in particular. We want to thank you all. And also it was great fun talking to Doris Kearns Goodwin, particularly about the Boston Red Sox and their World Series championship. So happy holidays to everyone, and a happy and prosperous new year. We'll be here back after the new year and look forward to talking to you then. Till then, this is Bennett Kelly, Court is Adjourned. See you next year here on Cyber Law and Business Report on webmasterradio.fm. Download our mobile app and take us with you wherever you go in the holidays. I hear St. Bart's is nice, so hope to go there through you guys. And tell us, send us postcards. I want to know where we've been. But please, download our mobile app. You can listen to us anytime, anywhere. Cheers.
This has been a presentation of WebmasterRadio.fm, the world's largest business-to-business radio and podcast network. We welcome you to sample past episodes of this program, as well as our complete library of programs, on demand or on the air via our 24/7 live audio stream at www.webmasterradio.fm. The opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and hosts and do not necessarily reflect those of WebmasterRadio.fm's management or sponsors. Any rebroadcast or redistribution without authorized consent of WebmasterRadio.fm is prohibited.